Hi, this is Abraham Engel. Welcome to Neighborhood Diaries. In 2009, I recorded the location-based memories of Portland tours and wove them together into these free interactive audio tours. You can download more tours by searching for Hood Turkey in the iTunes Store or by going to my website at www.hoodturkey.com, where you can also check out my other projects. This project was supported in part by a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council and by generous folks like you. To find out how you can donate with one click, go to hoodturkey.com. Unless otherwise stated, all the memories you hear were recorded by me, and all the music underneath them was composed by me, but I had lots of help with editing and other things by the following amazing people: Johnny Toadvine, Lena Munde, Nancy Wong, Mia Armstrong, and Carl Hugo. Also, I want to thank all my friends and family. Alright, so listen up. This is how you use the tour. I'm not going to be giving you a lot of directions. They're free maps you can download at hoodturkey.com if you haven't already picked one up. This is the memory-only tour, which means that there's no music in between the memories. So when one memory ends, just pause your player and hit play again when you reach the next location. You can let the natural sounds of the neighborhood be your soundtrack. If this is the iPod-enhanced version, you'll notice markers in the timeline. This means you can skip and go back to memories as if they were songs. Even if you don't use the iPod-enhanced version, you can look at the map and see the times at which each memory is played, so you can jump around that way. Alright, one last thing before we start the tour. This is a long tour, and the memories are kind of crunched up in some places and sprawled out in other places, so feel free to break them up at your own discretion. You won't hurt my feelings by not hurting your feet. With that said, we'll start the tour. Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory and or money and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening.
Right here on the corner of Fremont and Williams was a tavern. And we used to walk lightly because in our minds, a tavern was a place where men would come out and kidnap you, so we thought. So when we went by the tavern, we made sure we were very quiet and we almost tiptoed even though it was in broad daylight. I used to meet one of my little girlfriends. We used to walk home from Boise School for lunch, and then at a certain time, we'd walk down this way, and we'd meet here on the corner of Ivy and Williams, and there was an ice cream store called 24 Flavors. When we were buying ice cream was a nickel a scoop, and I remember my girlfriend and I arguing with the proprietor of the store when it went up to a dime. We thought that was terrible. Compared to what it costs now. And at that time, they used to have a double ice cream cone. So it was one, the handle, then it was two cups. And I remember we used to get a scoop of each flavor of ice cream, and sometimes a third. And that was 15 cents. That was a lot of money. But that was a treat. Bop City Records used to be right here, and in those days, teenagers used to come, buy their 45 records, and the music was always blaring from the windows and the doors, and it was always the latest hit. Next door to Bop City Record was a grocery store. And this grocery store at the time that I lived in the neighborhood was called Whitney's. It was a store. It had a wooden floor, had the old-fashioned refrigerators for the milk and the things that needed to be kept cold. We used to come to the store to buy penny candy, and sometimes our parents would send us to the store to get items that we needed. And we used to, on the way out, stop and read the comic books. And we used to sit down underneath the little bookshelf that they had there. And sometimes the store manager would chase us out because, you know, you needed to either buy them and read them or not read them at all. Okay, Williamson Monroe, right where these houses stand, there used to be a cleaners here. And the man who owned it was named Howard. It was Howard's Cleaners. And my dad used to walk me over here because he'd bring pants here to be pressed or cleaned or whatever. And I had a stuffed animal, a little elephant, that my dad had got me. And I took him everywhere with me. And I remember Howard used to tease me and say he was going to cut my elephant's trunk off. And when I used to go visit Howard with my dad, I'd leave Dumbo at home because I didn't want him to lose his trunk. Cleo's was a place where us kids knew nothing about. We weren't supposed to know anything about because it was an adult entertainment, not like adult entertainment as we see it today. It was just in a place where adults went. You had to be 21 or over. So we weren't allowed to go anywhere near Cleo's.
During the 1960s on Williams and Russell, which at that particular time was the heart of the black business community. Williams Avenue and Vancouver Avenue at those particular times were both two-way streets. And on Williams and Russell, there used to be a place sandwiched in between by the name of Top Q. And this is a billiard hall owned by Mr. Slaughter. It's now sort of a vacant lot now being developed for Emmanuel Hospital expansion. My memory is going in there and playing pool as a young man, and you had all types of people in there, and that was a very interesting place. It was a very unique place. That place, along with Cleo's, was where the black men went and shot pool, played cards. All types of hustling was going on in those days. Well, Mr. Slaughter was a very interesting gentleman, as well as a lot of other people who came in there. A friend of mine, Andrew, and I used to go in all the time hustling pool, primarily nine ball. And there were a lot of other great players, billiard players in there. Every now and then we would sneak over from the Top Q and go over to Amato's Supper Club, where Amato's had a pool hall there too. So, well, let's see. My nickname at that time was Nine Ball Banny. There were a lot of people that we played. I remember one time playing a gentleman by the name of, maybe I better not mention his name. God rest his soul. But I cut a nine ball in the side pocket, and we were playing for a little chump change at the time. It seemed like a lot of money during those days, especially on people on minimum wage, and which was probably $1.25 an hour at the time. And I was a shipping clerk making about that much. It amounted to about $200 a month. Jack, sometimes we call him Crying Jack. He damn near broke down the rack after witnessing that shot and losing all his money.
As the years went by, as we got toward the 60s, we weren't allowed to come to the park because there was a gang. It was called the Bandana Gang. It was a group of teenagers, and they were called the Bandana Gang because they used to have these bandanas that they wore around their heads and hanging out of their pockets, however. And the leader of the gang was named Tiny Dalton, and Tiny Dalton wore a mohawk. I mean, which was out. I mean, you think kids wear mohawks now are outrageous. Can you imagine back in the late 50s, early 50s, to see a guy in a mohawk? We weren't allowed to come to the park anymore unless we were supervised with an adult because of that gang. They were mild. They did nothing like gangs do today. They didn't do anything. They just hung around. That was it. They didn't beat up anybody. You never heard about them, you know, drive-bys, anything like that. They were just a menacing-looking group of guys. Vancouver Avenue Baptist Church, at that time, the church was white, and it would look more like a clapboard, sort of. It was all wood, not brick as you see it today. I attended my first funeral in that church, and not being used to a gospel sort of situation, I remember huddling under my aunt when the music got a little loud and the reverend began to get a little animated with his preaching.
I want you to hold on to each other. Something is getting ready to happen. Somebody's going to be made free. Members, I want you to hold on to each other.
I was right in between Ganton Vine and Fargo. I have a childhood friend I grew up with who I still see today. She lived across the street. I knew everybody on the block. Everybody knew us, all of us kids. Where the Red Cross is, there was a house. People lived in it. Their names were Mr. and Mrs. Overholt, and they looked like something out of a storybook. He had a garden, and it took up a whole lot where a house used to stand. His wife grew rhubarb, and she used to give it to my grandmother. My grandmother would make rhubarb pudding for us kids. I never liked it. My twin brother and sister did. Another thing was there was an embankment that led up to their house, and I used to sit there and I used to wait for my father to get off of the bus in the evening to come home from work. Then he'd get off and I'd run down to the corner to meet him and walk with him the rest of the way home. One of my friends, her brother and I, all of us were really good friends. We were coming home from the bakery one day, and there was a tree here, and I think a tree here. But I remember they were some type of a nut tree. There were cans and rocks and things down in the street. We decided we were going to pick them up and see who could hit the top of the porch. Being 7, 8 years old, the stairs seemed like they went on forever. So we were throwing rocks and cans up on the porch, not thinking. The man came out, ran out of the house to grab us. We ran all the way home. He ran to his house across the street. I ran and hid in the backyard. The man came out, he spoke to my grandmother, and next thing I knew, I guess she saw me run in the backyard and she called me in. She wanted to hear my version of the story. I think that was the first time I lied to any adult. I told her that we were trying to get nuts out of the tree and the cans were going up on the porch. She believed us. The bakery, you used to be able to see the bread after it was baked up on the conveyor belt going to be cut and wrapped. And my dad would hold us up so we could look in the window and see the bread on the conveyor belt. We thought that was the biggest deal. Another store that used to be on the block was Fremont Market. Fremont Market was a grocery store in the front with a butcher in the back. And my grandmother would always send me with a note when she wanted a certain cut of meat to give to the butcher. And the butcher would cut the meat, wrap it up, and give it to me and tell me to tell my grandmother, Mrs. Walker, tell Mrs. Walker I said hello. And I used to go and buy hamburger. She always told us to get ground chuck because it had less fat in it. Then she'd had me get 10 cents worth of dry onions and half a gallon of milk, which was 50 cents at that time. And I'd take the stuff home, and she'd mix the onions with a hamburger and make spaghetti sauce or red beans and rice and feed us. There was a little store called the Evening Grocery, which was a little mom-and-pop grocery store. And sometimes, when it was warm on those summer evenings, my mom and dad would just walk up to the store with me, and we'd just maybe buy an ice cream bar or a candy bar or something, and then walk back home. And I think she did that just to get me tired so that I would go to sleep. And at that time, walking just those few blocks, to me, was like walking miles. And I would always the proverbial, are we almost there?
The following interview was donated to me by Apricot Irving of the Wonderful Boise Voices Project, where young people from the Boise neighborhood interview elders from the Boise neighborhood. So the interviews were given to me, and then I edited them and composed music to them. So you'll hear some of their voices in here sometimes. You should check out Boise Voices at www.boisevoices.com. And thanks to Apricot for letting me use the memory.
I was born in the Boyce neighborhood. I was born on beach in Vancouver.
Did you enjoy living there?
Yes, my childhood growing up, my first 17 years, it was a corner house, one block from the Wonder Bakery.
Where did your father go to work, and what did he do?
My father owned a menswear store, and it was located in downtown Portland, on Broadway and Salmon. One of the interesting things is that he walked to work from beach in Vancouver all the way to the store. It took him an hour, and then he took the streetcar home. We used to buy from a meat market on Fremont Street, Fremont and Williams, And we used to charge and then pay for the food at the end of the month. You know, they charged to us. And my mother would give me the money to go pay the butcher. And whenever I paid the bill, he would give me a box of animal crackers. So I was always happy to pay the bill. Well, there was an empty lot next to Williams. There was an empty lot on Gattenbein Street between Beach and Failing. And it was an empty lot. And we once built a tunnel into the ground. And we had trees that we used to climb in. And it was a real playground, a natural playground. Not like one with swings and things, but just natural things to swing on and climb on. We would play softball at the intersections. On the corner of Beach and Haight, we would play softball at that intersection. We played in the street a lot, played football in the street, baseball, and then we played games called Annie Annie Eye Over and Kick the Can and games like that. Have you heard of games like that?
I used to live in a house that was on Commercial and almost Failing Street, right by Unthank Park. I lived there for about 3 years. We had a yard that did not have a fence, and we lived by an alleyway. So people would walk through our yard. We had a path that people would just walk on. So you would find all sorts of random stuff in the yard, like cigarettes or crack or, you know, paper or just stuff that people would just drop out of their pockets, gum. I was in the kitchen, which was right next to the yard, and kind of looking out into the back, and I heard this kind of weird kind of grumbling noise. And I looked out of the window. I was used to people walking through the yard. It's no big deal. Not that I loved it, because they would look in the windows and stuff, but I was just like, oh, it's just some guy walking through the yard. But he was actually facing the window of our house, of the kitchen. And he was loading a gun facing the window and looking toward the street as if he were sort of hiding. I have seen guns before, not in the wild, you know, just sort of contained. Mostly in people's homes, they're not loading them. I did not know what to do at all. I just sort of fell down onto the floor like, ah, what do I do? What do I do? But the guy left like relatively soon after that, and he went into the alley. I just fell down, like, a gun, okay, on the ground, in the kitchen. It was a very shiny gun. Mostly that's what I remember about it, is that it was very shiny. It was like supernaturally shiny. At the time I was living there, Unthank Park had a lot of kind of violent stuff happening, but they had play equipment, so I would go there anyways. At one point, I did find like a bag of crack in the yard, which I had never actually seen crack before. It was very weird. It looked like incense to me. I'm like, what is this? Oh.
at a house which at the time and perhaps now still is known as the Fuck Pit, which is on Shaver, the second to last house before you get to I-5. That's the south side of the street. And anyway, there was a show there, and this house used to have a lot of shows, and it's even in a book that was edited by Thurston Moore about punk houses that have shows and stuff. They haven't had one for a long time, though, so I'm sure it's fine to tell people where it is. I mean, it's in a book. It's a landmark at this point. But around that time, this was the summer of 2004, and there was this huge house show scene in that whole part of town that I was, like, really into. Even though I lived way out in Selwood, I would bike like 45 minutes to go to house shows over in North and Northeast. Mostly because I was 20 years old and couldn't go to shows like anywhere else because I wasn't old enough to go to bars. And I really liked the atmosphere because it seemed just pretty lawless. Looking back on it, it reminds me of Haight Ashbury in San Francisco, like in the late 60s. Obviously, I wasn't there, but just from what I've read about that time, it seems a lot like it. You know, you'd just go and there'd be some crazy experimental band in a living room somewhere, and strangers would just pass you a pipe or whatever. And, like, you know, and the more of these shows you'd go to, the more you would learn about, and they're not publicized or anything. You just have to hear about them. And so it got to where eventually I could go to a show, a house show, any night of the week. There's still house shows in that area, but it's not like that anymore as far as I know. I mean, maybe I'm just not as connected as I was, but it seems to me that, you know, at the time there was this general sense that no one really cared about most of the houses over there. Mississippi was starting to gentrify, and there were new businesses, you know, coffee shops and buildings being renovated and stuff. But for the most part, the houses were really cheap. I think, you know, you could get a house pretty easily for $800 and, you know, pack four people in it. And that's like $200 a piece. And these houses were really run down and rentals. And they just it seemed lawless because you were surrounded by other people like that. And they didn't care if you were noisy or if you had a party on a Tuesday night that went till 3 a.m. because they might do the same thing the next night, you know? I went to this show there, and it was a band, Wistafamond, who still plays around, I think. Just really loud, sort of free jazz metal, basically. I went all by myself, which is pretty unusual, because usually I would go with people, just a couple of friends or something, because I hadn't really made friends in this scene, even though I was sort of part of it. I would make friends with the bands, I guess, occasionally, just, you know, when are you playing next and stuff like that. But when I would go by myself, I'd do a lot of standing around awkwardly because the only people I really knew were the bands, and they were like busy like setting up and playing and stuff. And you know, so I'd just stand there. In this case, there was this really cute girl there who had tattoos of birds on her stomach. It was summer, so she was wearing a shirt where you could see like her stomach, and she had these birds, and she just like saw me standing there and pulls a beer out of her backpack and just like hands me a Pabst, you know. And I start talking to this girl and like totally just hit it off with her, you know. And it was interesting because all these nights that I went to these shows, I like expected something like this to happen, and it never did. I was always just like, yeah, tonight's the night I'm gonna meet an awesome, you know, girl. Because I sort of romanticized the scene, and I wanted to date that scene. I wanted a girl who came from it, who was, you know, represented the sort of just the counterculture and the just under the radar the whole thing was. Like, I wanted someone to sort of guide me through it. And I thought the whole thing was really sexy. You know, there's something really sexy about secret shows. And in fact, like, later on I would take girls on first dates to house shows like all the time, and it would work incredibly well because they would just be like amazed that this exists. But anyway, finally, this cute girl, I've struck a conversation with a completely random cute girl who isn't a friend of a friend or something, you know, so I have nothing to lose, so I can feel free to take risks and flirt with her and everything. These shows end pretty early at like 10 o'clock and everyone's drunk, and I just ended up walking back with her over to the waterfront. There's like a spot right at the edge of Boise, like I think it's still North Portland, like between like the Steel Bridge and the Broadway Bridge. But anyway, we just walked over there and like it made out and stuff, and the whole time I assumed this girl was older than me because she had beer, you know, but it turned out that she was only 17 years old, which was, you know, it's legal and everything, because I was 20 and I never actually slept with this girl or anything, but I just thought it was funny that, you know, she was just so part of like that underground scene that she seemed older than me because she had a beard and she had tattoos. Because I feel like that's over now, that there aren't shows that are just totally under the radar. If you have a show on a Tuesday, you know, on Shaver these days, the police are going to come. It's just kind of over. And when I think back to that, that's like my favorite night probably from the whole thing.
Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory and or money and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening. You can find out more about this and other projects at www.hoodturkey.com. Thanks, and have a safe trip home.